Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast. Content discussed on this podcast is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals. Now, let's start with the quote of the week.
The Marines have a saying, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. The center of bringing any dream into fruition is self-discipline.
G'day guys, welcome back to another Friday Wrap. It's David here. Sorry I've been missing in action last week. Internet's giving me a bit of grief last week, but changed providers and managed to jump back on again now faster than ever, let's put it that way. So, but good to be back, that's for sure. Another action-packed week, I should say, both in, I guess, all the asset classes, I should say. There's been a lot of actions that have been happening around the commodity space. Obviously, hashtag silver squeeze, which we'll get John to cover a bit later. There's been a lot of share markets movements as well, and not to mention property too. I think there's a lot to cover today. So, gents, how are we doing? Jazz?
Really good, buddy. I'm glad your internet's up because last week we were all over the shop. It's when I'm with John, we are off chain.
I think that's good. It actually gives people a bit of different flavor, right? So, it just became more of a commodity episode rather than an actual rap episode. But people love it, I would say.
I'm sure John loved it. Right, John?
You got me on my favorite topic. GameStop, I think we talked about last week.
Yeah, mate. GameStop.
Very interesting stuff. Good to be back. Looking forward to another great episode.
That's awesome.
That's it. Good to be back on deck as well with both of you. I listened to the GameStop episode. I find it really interesting as well. So I'm sure our listeners do too. So maybe from time to time, we'll get you guys to cover that and go off rail so that our listeners will get a bit of flavor. We don't have to go the conventional way of wrapping every Friday news as we need to. But anyway, I think we'll give a bit of broad brush again this week. So back to our conventional wisdom. What do we want to talk about? Let's start off with the macro stuff then, in that case. So I think one thing that is usually being overlooked this week is the RBA cash rate. So they had their first meeting this month for February, and basically no surprise, RBA has decided to keep the cash rate at 0.1%, no movement on that. But what's interesting out of the announcement is that RBA has also announced that they are going to purchase an additional 100 billions of bonds issued by the Australian government and states. Okay, so that's equivalent to about a current rate of $5 billion a week pumping into our financial system. Gents, from a macro perspective, how is that? What do you guys see? Like, why would RBA do this at this point in time? Why are they doing this?
Well, I think because when all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So they're gonna stimulate until some sort of an end game. So they said they're not going to move interest rates. They're going to inject $100 billion of QE into the banking system. And if you asked me 2 years ago, could Australia do QE, I would have said that's a privilege reserved for the reserve currency, that for any other country, if New Zealand was to do QE, it would destroy the currency. But here we are, the RBA can do QE too, apparently. Look, I think they're trying to get either a commodity-led recovery or a real estate-led recovery via inflation. Mm. So they're trying to pump up asset prices to lead to all sorts of spending and investment decisions and all this sort of hyper-present tense, so all this bringing all this investment decision into the present. Everyone on the planet's doing it. I suppose it wasn't a surprise. It didn't really move markets. The only thing I'd say is that in the US overnight, since we're on macro, I'll tie it into the QE for the RBA. In the US markets overnight, they announced another 700,000 new first-time unemployment benefits recipients. And they also announced that productivity had decreased by 5%, which was the most since 1981, 40 [S2] Wow. [S1] Years ago. Where I'm going with this is that you can't fix those problems with QE. You can't fix those problems with currency creation. You can only fix it by allowing goods and services to re-enter the economy. So we're, I think this is how bankers think. I think this is what bankers do, but I don't think it solves the problem. I think this is just currency creation and inflation. But it's going to make David and Jazz very busy through new mortgages to real estate investors. So that it will have the desired effect of pumping up property prices.
Mm-hmm. Just to add two things, pretty much on what John said. One is negative rates. RBA clearly wants to avoid the negative rates. They don't want to be the first one. They'll probably watch a few other countries or continents doing it before Australia does it, especially New Zealand probably. And the main reason I think they've done their QE program again is purely because they have obviously run out of the rate lever, which is they can't drop the rates anymore. So, and they don't want the rates to go into negative. So, combine both the situations, the only thing you're left with is really QE to inflate the economy. Otherwise, it will become stagnant or deflationary, and you don't want to be in a deflationary environment when you've got that much debt sitting on you, right? So, just if you add those two together, it's pretty clear why RBA is doing QE, and it won't surprise if they do more over the next few years, especially when you see all the other countries doing it and their currencies slowly going down pretty much to nothing, worthless over time. It will be, even though if RBA becomes prudent and doesn't do QE, it's probably going to end up harming to some extent because all the other countries are doing it, and then Aussie dollar gets stronger, all the dominoes start to fall because of that. Obviously, we are a major mining exporter. That will hurt the mining to some extent as well. So no surprises over there. I think it's very obvious. And to your point, David, what you said at the start, all the asset classes, whether it's commodities or whether it's property or look at crypto at the start of this year, it's just blown through the roof, right? So all these are the signs of the money that is being pumped into the system, the free money, unproductive money. So we'll see inflation, I think, a lot more inflation over the next 2 years. I think, I don't know whether you guys noticed or not, but I did. I bought a coffee cup 2 days ago in the morning, my normal morning coffee shot. And the price, even though it only went up by 20 cents, but that's a pretty good indicator that the prices are starting to shoot up. Maybe it's a silly one to look at, but it works for me.
You raise an excellent point about the currency. Like maybe because the Aussie dollar hit 77 cents this week, maybe the QE was just a way to put a lid on that.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's both. It's both providing funding and, that's the only way to control the currency right now. How else will you control the currency? I just can't think of another way of doing it if you are out of the rates option.
Especially when everyone else is also printing money like there's no tomorrow, right? So it's kind of like Australia's being forced to also jump on the bandwagon. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, yes, as you said, it's going to basically start damaging our exports, which is what we don't want to see because the currency is going too high. So, but interesting how that's going to pan out in the next couple of years, that's for sure, especially with inflation and asset prices across all asset classes. Basically, is what we're seeing. So, you know, which reminds me, John, like what you said last year, it's going to be volatile as crazy this year. So, you know, just imagine another, all these, I'm starting to lose a number of zeros in the back, right? It's down to like 50 billion, 500 billion. It's like nothing. It's like a normal figure. Whereas a couple of years ago, it would be like, that is the amount of crazy money they're trying to put into the system now.
Yeah. And David, if you allow me, we were going to discuss this chart at the end, but I'm just bringing it up now.
Yeah, sure.
We are already on the topic. Is the housing interest payments to income. If we look at that chart, the interest repayments to versus income, we are at our lowest point since 1999. So, and John, before the recording, did mention that I think the biggest boom in the property market was between 1999 to 2004. Correct me if I'm wrong, John, but that sort of is another good indicator that tells you that we are only just getting started with this property run. especially with all the lockdown that we saw, people now will try and move around, lifestyle, sea change, tree change, whatever it is. But that chart itself tells you that the property market is right on the cusp.
Yeah. It also tells you that people buy property based on what proportion of their income goes to the repayment, not how many times income the whole the property is worth. So they say, oh, you know, property is for the first time 5 times the average median income, but the repayment is not. So people buy property based on how affordable the repayment is, not the price of the property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That seems to be the new indicator nowadays, basically, when people are purchasing properties, yeah?
I think it was in the episode last week, no, the 1 week before we would discuss that debt is your asset, isn't it?
That's the asset, the property's the liability.
Exactly. Again, be careful. This is not a financial advice. Don't listen to us. It's just what's happening in the markets. But, yeah, that chart I thought was interesting, right? That's all.
Yeah. No, it's a good point. And I think whilst we're on the topics of property, we may as well cover a few of those things that that we have here. So I think, Jazz, you shared the CoreLogic Daily Home Value Index ended on the 27th of January 2021. Mm-hmm. You did highlight that Adelaide has got the biggest change year on year. What's the story there?
Again, I think one of the Adelaide is not a boom bust type property market. We all know that very well. It's a very
slow, steady,
smooth performer. Goes 3-4% over its time frame. But I think one of the major reasons again for the Adelaide property market to be performing is one, it has underperformed over the last few years. Property prices relative to Melbourne and Sydney are much more cheaper. Two is, I think it's the internal migration that's happening within the states that's driving the Adelaide property market quite a lot. Because even when I'm speaking to some of the locals in Victoria, Melbourne, they're talking about, you know, whether they want to move to Adelaide or Brisbane and all that stuff, right? So purely because the affordability, it's the affordability is your reason, right? So if you can buy a property right next to a beach, as an example, Christie's Beach or Port Norlunga, whatever it is, for under 500K, and you can get a job within 30 minutes of radius, or for Adelaide, 30 minutes is probably too long, but maybe 15 to 20 minutes of radius. And you've got that beautiful lifestyle available as well at the same time. So I think people are just trying to move away from big debt scenarios and also tired of what's happened last year with COVID. So I think we'll see Brisbane, Adelaide, and to some extent Perth more because of the mining reason, to be good performers over the next few years, in my opinion.
Yeah, people are starting to find a balance, basically, in terms of finding that balance between life and where they want to live, and in terms of the commute that they want to, right? So that's basically an outcome of the COVID that we've just gone through. Yeah. But interesting enough, I think if we look at the, looking at all these figures, it's all positive, right? Like it's all green, except for Melbourne, who's going through a strong recovery at the moment, if we're looking at the figures. But in terms of the quarter-on-quarter change, you know, I think the biggest winner here at the moment is Perth. It's because of all the mining boom that's currently going at the moment, in that degree, followed by Adelaide, right? So 3.36% quarter-on-quarter change for Perth, and 3.18% for Adelaide. So these two are the biggest gains, two biggest cities in the gains for the last quarter. So Sydney's also done pretty well. I think 2% year-on-year, which is pretty good. Melbourne had a little drop, negative 2% year-on-year. However, as I said, you know, that's partly because of the COVID lockdown that you guys had last year, in 3 months. So we're expecting a very, very strong recovery and a strong growth across the year. And this is only January that we're talking about at this point in time. So John, if you go.
Yeah, that's my key point. Sorry, David. Yeah. It's January, right? So we are only getting started, and we've got 2 years of this run to look at. So it will be interesting. But keen to hear what John thinks about this.
I totally agree. The CoreLogic data for January was interesting, but because of the low volumes at this time of year, you don't want to draw too many conclusions. Some of the quarterly and the annual data was more interesting. So I agree with everything you guys said. One thing I'd add as a footnote is that I've got some Darwin data in front of me, and Darwin is the top performing capital. It did 6.6%, nearly 7% last quarter. And in January alone, it did 2.5%. So Darwin's on track for 30% this year. And, of course, Darwin's been going down for, like, 15 years. So,
yeah.
Just to show you...
playing catch-up now.
Yeah, it really illustrates how stable Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne are. Mm-hmm. So they're really the sort of the core real estate markets in Australia. And we look at the numbers and say, Sydney and Melbourne are... they will perform the least, but they never underperform that much either. In the bad years, they're down by a very small amount. In the up years, they're up by a small amount. But over decades and decades, Sydney and Melbourne do great.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing. So Darwin's doing really well. The other thing is that we're still seeing the tree change, but it seems to be slowing down a bit. And the tree change that I'm seeing in the month is... So the flight to regionals as opposed to capital cities, I think it's slowing down. So it's still happening. It's still a big theme. But as people, as lockdowns finish and people are going back to work and you know, the boss starts banging on the table, I want you in 3 days a week, that sort of thing, I think that the tree change thing will be a bit of a fad or a bit of a thing that retirees do. I think people retire in the country towns, but I think that the capital cities will reassert themselves as where the best real estate is. So that'll be interesting to watch. It's still happening, but it's slowing down that tree change.
So regional growth, can the figures at the moment in terms of the regional growth trend started to reflect that?
Yeah, so the regionals, just in January, the regionals were up 1.6%
mm-hmm.
and the capitals were up 0.7%, and that includes Darwin as a capital.
Okay, yep.
So... the regionals are outperforming by 2 to 3 times, but if you look at it over the year, they were outperforming by about 5 times. So it means that it's starting to narrow. The regionals are starting to slow down, and the capitals are starting to catch up, I think.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see the trend, because obviously we've got the January data now, but maybe when we move into February and March in terms of how regional growth versus the capital city growth at that point in time, I think that'll give us a bit of indication on how that tree change trend is really happening and whether people are slowly moving back into more of a CBD area again.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Also, just while we are on property, it's going to be on property for the next few minutes now, I think. David, we've got that net internal migration chart which is provided by Macquarie.
Yep.
Keen to see what both of you guys think on this one, where obviously the net internal migration has been dropping within Sydney and especially Melbourne. Melbourne is negative 15%, and Sydney, I think, is about negative 7 or 8%, more like 7% kind of thing.
Yeah.
What do you guys think of when you look at this chart and looking at the net internal migration? Does that mean kind of what we discussed last year when we were doing the wrap up, that we'll see more growth in the Perth and some of the other smaller cities compared to Melbourne and Sydney, just looking at this one chart, especially knowing that there's not going to be much overseas migration anyways over the next year, let's say. And then looking at the internal migration chart, which is this one, it looks just a little bit interesting, that's all. So maybe start with David.
I think it's more of partly because of the livability, as we mentioned, but also to do with the affordability as well. You know, now that people can see that there is, they got the option and they don't have to be in the office all the time, right? So that was what's being reflected last year, and that's where everyone is starting to move. Right, well, why don't we move somewhere else? You know, for Sydney, for example, let's go to Gosford, which you can still commute to city, you know, on a fast train, maybe around 1 to 1.5 hours on express train. So in that sense, and, you know, if someone only needs to commute to the office for about 1 or 2 days a week, then logically speaking, that would make sense for them to kind of move further away, so out of migration. Now, the funny thing about this chart is it doesn't say where they go to. I think that'll be interesting to see where out of Sydney. Now, is it saying, is it out of Sydney, does that include in Greater Sydney? Does that include regionals? Or, you know, like, if they say, for example, if they move to Gosford, does that count as net internal migration outside of Sydney, or is that still within Sydney?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think looking at it, that's the way I interpret it is, you know, and especially when we compare all the years across from 2001 to 2021 towards now, you know, Melbourne, understandable because of COVID, everyone's, you know, with Daniel Andrews being such a harsh in terms of the COVID restrictions, I think you guys are starting to put mask mandatory back on again, mm-hmm. right, from memory. So that's probably going to irritate a lot of people and go, well, I don't want to be living this city anymore because, you know, it keeps going on and off, on and off. I'm going to move to another state. So that could be something that drives that as well in terms of, you know, the premier's stance towards the COVID in that. So, but in the longer run, I think looking at how housing market at the moment is trending and there's still so much demand for Sydney and Melbourne properties, it shows that people are still wanting to live in the city, even though they're, you know, a good chunk of people decided to move out. But, you know, there's still so much pent-up demand and that means people still want to be here. So I reckon it might be a short-term thing in terms of that, you know, and we'll see that spike slowly coming back in as COVID starts to get more under control and as basically people have to go back to the office a bit more in that sense. So mm-hmm. that's the way I interpret it. I know. Mm-hmm. John, what do you reckon?
Yeah, look, I think this chart just shows that Sydney and Melbourne in particular over the last decade or so is just highly dependent on migration, on people coming in.
Yep.
And interstate migration is obviously a big part of that. To bring it back to property, one of the things that I see as one of the biggest trends around is that if there aren't new people coming into the country from overseas, how come property prices are going up? And what's happening is that all these new buyers are actually former renters that are being dragged into the buying market because they've discovered that buying is cheaper than renting. And we, you know, Jazz put up that chart earlier, which had the amount of the repayments going down to 1981 levels. These are renters who are buying for the first time because they're not new Australians, they're not new citizens. So, you know, if you want your rent to go up, I think there's going to need to be some immigration fairly soon. And I think that the politicians are aware of that. But it is interesting, you know, I think there's this big phenomenon of people coming home and wherever home is, home might be Adelaide or Perth or Canberra, but people are going home. I caught up with two Australian expats coming back from New York City this week, two in 1 week, looking to buy property. So mm-hmm. It's interesting that there's this kind of moving back home, big theme.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
What do you think, Chaz? What's your interpretation here?
Look, I pretty much agree with what both of you have said, to be honest. There's not a lot more to add. I think I think remote work is, in my opinion, the main reason, to be honest. When people know they can work remotely, I think that's the main reason. It's the remote work that has really kicked people into gear of why buy these much expensive houses and live in a smaller house with bigger debt and more traffic situation kind of thing. Then when we can live more in a piece of place with their family can grow and all that stuff. Obviously, it doesn't suit every family requirements, but generally speaking, a blanket approach. So I think that is one of the key reasons, in my opinion, along with the... I was going to talk about the external migration, but let's just leave that aside. So, but that's the main reason, I think.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, it's good. All right. Well, I mean, last topic on the property today, because we want to make sure that John gets to talk about his silver squeeze this week to keep all those people updated. Looking back at one of those topics that we spoke about, Jazz, you know, last year in terms of the SQM research predictions, you know, they did make some predictions early last year in terms of how 2021 property is going to pan out for different cities. And, you know, we've got four scenarios, you know, with a base case, scenario two, scenario three, scenario four, you know, all different variants in terms of QE, JobKeeper, et cetera, et cetera. And at the moment, I think, Jazz, I think we all agree that looking like at the moment scenario three, which states that, you know, better than expected rollout vaccine in first half of the year. That is correct. That's on the way. Mm-hmm. Bounce in employment. Yes, we got a strong rebound in employment at the moment, employment figures. Mm-hmm. No more lockdowns. State borders remain open. Regional hubs open. That's partly true. I mean, Perth at the moment is in the lockdown. Mm-hmm. Victoria is obviously looking at tidying up, but in general, no strict lockdowns across, you know, multiple states at the moment, and borders still remain relatively open. So that's also true to an extent. JobKeeper phased out as planned. So at the moment, end of March, that's still on the cards. I think I saw the news that Josh Frydenberg is not looking at extending that, or ScoMo's said that, something like that. Mm-hmm. So that's on track, and QE scale back after mid-year. So at the moment, based on what we just said, we've got the $5 billion per week that's currently pumping up, but they want to stop that before mid-year at the moment. So it's pretty accurate predictions in terms of what this scenario three has covered, I must say, Jazz. Mm-hmm. But what do you think of the figures?
I think even if you look at the numbers, we talked about the Perth property market last year.
Yep.
And the numbers aren't, this is 2021 scenario, but it looks like that's how it's panning out. John just touched on the Darwin market.
Yes.
For the year, it's got 3-6% growth, 2021. And Brisbane somewhere between 5-10%. So Perth somewhere between 10-15% growth for 2021. So it looks like those are the ballpark figures that we are going to achieve this year. And it's clearly we are more headed towards the scenario three. So I think clearly Perth will be the clearly the winner in this game.
John, what do you reckon? Have you got much thoughts on this?
All I'd say is I think that scenario three is what's panning out, but I think the forecasts are low. So here they've got, you know, Sydney 3-7%. It'll probably be more like 8-9%, same as Melbourne. And Darwin was 3-6% as well, but they did 6% in one quarter, so it'll be about four times. I think it's really way under-egging the forecast.
Yeah. Maybe the actual figures will be more closer to the base case, the scenario one, even though the criteria are more closer to scenario three, right? Because if you look at Darwin, that's about 6-9%. Perth is probably a bit under, but yeah. Mm-hmm. And overall, I think Chris's housing boom and bust report 2021 is pretty accurate in that regards. Except, yeah, obviously they've got to put their conservative hat on a little bit just in making these predictions, but. Mm-hmm. Again, I think it proves that it's going to be a good year for assets classes.
So just a quick one, both for John and David. Maybe start with David. Do you guys see this to be, it will outperform the boom cycle that we saw in 1999 to 2004, or it will be kind of similar, or it won't be as aggressive as that cycle of 1999 to 2004?
I actually don't know the boom in 1999 to 2004. I wasn't in the property game at that point in time, to be honest. John, do you know the figures around what the boom figures are, on top of your head, or?
John, that's his way of saying that you're the oldest in the group, sir.
Yeah, that is true. I don't have the figures in front of me, but what I can say is that the property market was booming, the Aussie dollar was booming, and migration was booming. Because don't forget, it was in the lead up to the 2000 Olympic Games. So it was a big time for infrastructure, it was a big time for migration and so on. So we've got a couple of those factors. We've got low interest rates, declining interest rates. We've got a rising Australian dollar that we can't seem to keep in the a lid on. Do I think it'll be bigger? Oh, and a rising commodity market. That's the other thing. So the commodities, when commodities and real estate go up at the same time, that equals inflation. That's very inflationary, and that's what they're trying to... They'll have to manage that. Is it going to be bigger or less? I think, look, probably bigger. But so my overall thesis is that real estate doubles between 2019 and 2025. And I'm probably the only guy to say it, so I'm probably going to be wrong. But I think it doubles in that seven-year period, and I think we're 2 years into it.
Mm-hmm. John said it first.
See.
Spike the fire. Right. Yeah. I think so too. I mean, I'm echoing that to that degree. I mean, I don't know exact details of the boom around 99 to 04, but given the amount of money that's in the system at the moment, like what we've been seeing and what we've been saying, I mean, and all these data evidence that's just backing us up, you know, we're only in January at the moment. It's already going like it's crazy. And, you know, like we've been on the ground, we've been looking at inspections and what kind of stuff. You can clearly feel that the amount of demand for property at the moment is crazy. It's that fear of missing out factor, you know, like everyone is trying to jump on the bandwagon. I've got customers coming to me and say, I want to, how fast can we get credit? You know, because every week I'm missing out, you know, like, you know, for example, if I don't get a house in 1 week, I could be missing out a couple thousand dollars in terms of the growth. And that clearly shows a clear signs of FOMO in the market at the moment. So, you know, that's, which in turn is going to further drive the prices up. To that degree, because, you know, people pay silly prices. Like what? I mean, the closest one I can think of is back in about the 2014-15, around 2013 to 2015 period. That, when I was back in the market at that time, that it's exactly the same feeling, you know. So that's probably the closest analogy, except this time there's a lot more money in the system. A lot more money in the system than what we've ever seen before, in whether that's in the 99 boom or the 2013 to 2015 Sydney boom and the mining boom back at that time. So I reckon this time it's likely to be bigger.
And especially, David, again, in the same Slack channel, we've got the chart with the baseline scenario for the GDP, and it's talking about GDP figures in, so these are the predictions, obviously, for 2021 December. The prediction is the GDP will grow by 3.5%, and for December 2022, that's another 3.5%, and same for 2023, which is 3%. When you look at those kind of GDP figures, we're talking a lot of inflation over here, so it all really ties back to some extent.
Okay.
Yeah, this is nominal growth and not real growth. No one, our standard of living is falling. We have to bear that in mind. So our standard of living is falling, or at least those people without real estate or without certain physical assets, their standard of living is falling. This is because inflation is gobbling up all the nominal gains, and the central banks know it. They're targeting nominal growth, and they don't care about inflation for now. For now.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, I think that's enough in terms of the property this week. I'm sure our listeners cannot wait for John's special segment on his hashtag Silver Squeeze after last week's GameStop that he's made a good explanation there. So, John, do you want to touch on it in terms of what's happening this week in terms of our Wall Street Bets channel? Yeah.
For me, this was the biggest thing of the week. So I was absolutely fascinated with the whole Wall Street Bets thing, the Reddit investors. And so a couple of disclaimers. Firstly, I've never been on Reddit. So I'm not actually, I have nothing to do with these guys. I've never been on Reddit. I've never been on Wall Street Bets. So I'm receiving the tweets in copy paste format from Jazz. That's how I know what's going on in Twitter. It's from Jazz. But I've been following it. It's in the news, and silver doesn't make the news very often. So it was all over the financial news this week. So when we chatted last week, the Reddit guys attacked the short position in GameStop, and with great success, it's since come down. But they did announce late last week, like on Friday US time, so after our last podcast, that the next target was going to be the silver short. Now, the silver short is the big short on the planet. It's the most shorted asset. And so on Monday, the silver price went up by 9%, and my God, the silver equities, the junior miners, the miners, they went through the roof. They did 40, 50%, sometimes more. Then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, they got absolutely smacked down. So silver lost all of its upside from Monday, plus a bunch more. Now, the story is that silver bullion had been purchased and was not available anywhere in North America. So you couldn't buy silver on the planet if you wanted to. All the silver coin dealers and the bullion dealers and all that sort of stuff, they ran out of silver on Sunday night. So this was very big. And somehow silver ended the week down. To me, it's crazy. So now, let me kind of just lay out why they targeted silver. I said it was the biggest. It's the biggest short on the planet. The reason it's the biggest short on the planet is because apparently there are estimates of between 250 and 500 paper claims on every ounce of silver. So one bar of silver is owned by 500 people because the same bar of silver keeps getting rehypothecated. And what the Reddit investors tried to do was say, let's all buy silver bars and silver futures on the COMEX, and when the silver contract expires, we, instead of rolling it over into a new contract, we demand delivery. And they don't have it, and they're going to run out of silver. So this is the way to expose the big short, that they buy it, then they demand delivery, they don't have it, exposed. And look, it just hasn't happened. I mean, the silver price has been smacked down. You know, smarter people than me who know this market can probably explain why that is. But my guess is that the Reddit guys announced their intention and the people who hold the shorts were able to fight back. Now, the people who hold the shorts, I mean, the biggest company that owns the short is JP Morgan. And then they're not, you know, and the Reddit guys think they can take JP Morgan down. I think that that's crazy talk. So, you know, it was a very ambitious attempt. Maybe it's not over. It feels like it's over. The Reddit, the talk is that Reddit investors have moved on to biotech and other things. But the silver short squeeze didn't happen. It started promising and it fizzled out. What do you think, Jazz? I know that you kind of followed this as well.
I think there's a fight. There's a war going on between the Gen Z millennials and the boomers, it feels like. When you look at the Wall Street bets, which is all youngsters in their 20s, teens, 30s kind of thing, who have got some money, and a lot of them are these days also being backed by the Bitcoiners, who hold fairly decent chunk of money as well because the Bitcoin price has gone up. But then again, you're trying to fight against an elephant, which is likes of JP Morgan in this case. Just one thing on the GameStop. GameStop squeeze didn't happen just in a day or in a week. That game was well planned 2 years in advance. So it started kind of in 2019, 20, it started to ramp up. 2021, they managed to do it. So although this was a good, nice try, it was more of a learning exercise for the Wall Street bet guys to see what happens if you buy all the silver, physical silver, off the shops. But then obviously there's a paper market, which there is no easy way to audit, like some of these cryptos. They can be audited. They're very transparent, especially the public one, which is likes of Ethereum, Bitcoin, and some of the other ones. So there's no easy way to audit these silver markets to figure out how much of these paper silvers are actually being backed by physical silver. There's a talk of 30 to 40%. How much of that is true? Only JP Morgan knows that, because the people who audit JP Morgan's are probably being bought by JP Morgan's or their partners to some extent, in all honesty. So I think silver squeeze is going to happen. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So it may happen sometime this year or it may happen sometime next year. I think there's a high possibility that silver will see its all-time high towards the end of the year or sometime this year, whenever that happens. And we will see a silver mania, which is every second person jumping into it more towards the end of or mid of 2021, end of 2021, 22 kind of thing, where it will just go parabolic on a price discovery mode to figure out what the real price of the silver is. And then there's going to be a massive crash whenever that happens, from whether it's 200 or 600 down to find its new base. So I think that's coming. It's just a matter of if, not it's matter, sorry, it's not a matter of if, it's more of a matter of when it will happen. So it's a space to watch. It's a very interesting space. And that's why a lot of these miners are looking really interesting. Which brings us to the chart that we had. If you look at some of the best performers in the ASX so far this year, which is 2021, A lot of them have actually been the miners, whether it's the silver miners or whether it's the nickel or whether it's the gold, different rare earth, which is lioness and all that stuff. So there's a reason they are all starting to perform, because it's the commodities boom that's happening. It's just which one, we're specifically talking silver. When will silver shoot through the roof? I think I won't be surprised if it doubles this year, and it won't surprise me at all if it goes parabolic towards mid-end of next year, in my opinion. It's going to happen. It's just these Wall Street bet guys are making their arms a little bit more, or biceps a little bit more bigger to play with likes of JP Morgan.
Yeah. It's a big adversary. I mean, if they want to take JP Morgan down, they need to try a little bit harder. But also, the other thing about silver is silver's a commodity. I remember chatting on Sunday night about this. Like, silver's not, it's not like taking a small cap retailer down. It's a single share. There are multiple ways to buy silver, whereas there's only one way to buy GameStop. You buy the stock and you watch it go up. Mm-hmm. Silver, do you buy the physical? Do you buy the coins? Do you buy the bars? Do you buy the ETFs? Do you buy, and there are all these different kinds of ETFs, or do you buy the mining shares? So all this money probably had the right intention to go in and corner the silver market, but they didn't buy the same thing. They bought all these different things. That's the first thing. The second thing is, you're right. I still think this probably has legs, but they still need to wait for the contracts to expire. Mm-hmm. So the dominoes go, they buy the futures contracts and JP Morgan issues more paper and probably suppresses the price. But when it comes time to ask for delivery, that's when maybe the short squeeze happens, and that's probably a month away.
Mm-hmm. And it won't surprise me. I think silver topped out at around 30 last week with these Wall Street bet guys trying to squeeze silver markets. Or trying to figure out what the real price of silver is. It won't surprise me if in the next 4 to 5 weeks we see it crossing 30 bucks. I'm not a chartist. I'm not a trader. I don't know anything about that stuff. But it's I won't be surprised if that happens. But I've got a question for you, John. You mentioned before about JP Morgan or other third parties trying to short silver to keep it priced under a certain point. Why is that the case? Can you explain it to the listeners?
My wife asked me the same question, and because they're the sort of exciting conversations we have around the dinner table here at the Commono House. But
I thought I was your wife.
Yes, we chat more. So the way I put it, I'm not in this space personally, but the way I put it is, if you could sell your house 7 times and still possess it, wouldn't you do it? If you could have 500 claims on your house and never have to deliver the house to someone, you'd do it. You'd make so much money because you'd be selling the same piece of physical property over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
That's the hypothesis, at least. And look, this has been a hypothesis about the silver short since the 70s when the Hunt brothers tried to corner the market. So, do your own research. It may or may not be true. We know that JP Morgan does own the biggest silver stash in the world. Whether they're playing silly buggers with it, I don't know. But they certainly own a lot of silver, and they're the most likely shorters. It's very interesting.
I was going to say, just on that, I think this is the reason that likes of cryptocurrencies are becoming a little bit more popular among millennials, because some of that, or if you buy the right ones, they can be audited, verified. You can run your own nodes to confirm the transactions and all that stuff. Whereas with this game, it's almost impossible to tell. The game is commodities game is so rigged or manipulated by these big cartels, which is like some JP Morgan and all that. It's almost impossible to tell what's the right. Well, it's almost impossible to do the true price discovery on these things. So, I think
absolutely. Look, that's such a good point. And I'd add that that's why real estate's doing well, because with real estate you know that you own it. If you look at assets like an upside down pyramid, right? And so you've got all the physical assets down the bottom at the pointy bit, right? So that's where you've got your gold and your silver and your timber and your lumber and your real estate. And as the pyramid gets bigger and bigger, they're just paper derivatives. They're paper claims on the real assets that are the bottom. And as the pyramid gets bigger and bigger, you've got more and more people who own the same physical assets, but the physical assets are the only assets with value. Now, where does Bitcoin go? Well, Bitcoin's a digital representation of wealth, but it's not a derivative. It's not a derivative. So that would be down near the bottom where the real assets are. And so you want to kind of, when you're building your portfolio, you want to own stuff down the bottom and not the paper stuff there up the top, or at least you want to trade the stuff at the top and keep the stuff down the bottom, if that made any sense.
Yeah, so there's a difference between real wealth and paper wealth. And to give you the macro picture, the size of the derivatives market is about $600 trillion in the world, and the size of global GDP is about $85 trillion. The derivatives market's seven times the size, or six and a half times the size of all the goods and services produced on the planet. So, yeah, when the music stops, it's those paper pretend wealth that crashes, and the real wealth asserts itself. So, all roads lead to real estate.
Yeah. Interesting. Silver squeeze lap. Come on, guys. Make it happen.
That's
a big JP Morgan.
I'm sure there'll be more follow-on in the next few weeks. So, and you guys will be tracing it closely. So we'll provide further updates to our audiences then.
True. David, have we got anything else to cover?
Look, I think the only other thing I'll probably want to mention from finance space is the housing minister has released that there's an additional 1,800 spots to be released for first home loan deposit scheme. So for those first home buyers who want to be able to get into the space, with only 5% deposit. Previously, I think they released an additional 10,000 spots, but just for new homes. So this 1,800 is for existing homes. Okay, so for those people who's wanting to buy existing homes, they can now also get their foot in as quickly as they can. Mm-hmm. And I know the banks are obviously preparing to allow for these additional allocations, but it's still in the progress right now. So that is good. That is good news for a lot of first home buyers. Obviously, try to find in the market at the moment. Another additional 1,800 spots to be released, but there will be more details to be released in the next few weeks. So we'll do a follow up on that. Mm-hmm. Look, I think mindful of the time, I think that's pretty much it for this week. So anything else you guys want to cover?
Just be careful. Don't over-leverage, like we've always said. Yeah. Market's hot, and it's going to get hotter and hotter until it gets to the point where it's so frothy that the things start to move in the other direction. So just be careful. Interest rates are at their lowest point, so there's only one direction they can go. Actually, it can go negative, but let's just assume they're going to go up, hopefully. And if they do, you don't want to get hurt, burnt, kind of thing. But play safe, stay safe. And we will be back next week with what's happening in the markets. John, Jazz, and Evan. Cheers. Bye.